ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Fran Kelly, and this is the Radio National Hour, coming to you from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation in Sydney. Coming up, African migrants are being evacuated from South Africa following a spate of deadly assaults and growing protests targeting undocumented foreigners. They're being blamed for taking jobs, squeezing public services, and driving crime. Is this xenophobic scapegoating really a protest against a failing government? I'll get a view from South Africa in a moment. Also ahead, in some European nations, cooperatives account for as much as 40% of the housing stock, providing affordable and lifelong secure housing for millions of people. But here in Australia, it's still being dismissed really as a bit of a hippie ideal. As we look for solutions to the housing crisis, I'll talk to two people working to bring housing co-ops into the mainstream. And nearly 8 months on from the supposed ceasefire in Gaza, there's few green shoots rising from the rubble.
What is the conditions of life of a society? These are the infrastructure, the institutions of health, say, for example, conditions of cultural lives, schools and mosques. Conditions of life are obviously the homes.
In his new book, Ungrounding, forensic architect A.L. Weissman argues that the wholesale destruction of Gaza is a deliberate strategy of dislocation and displacement to remove people from their place, never to return. A mass exodus is underway in South Africa at the moment, with governments from neighbouring countries, including Malawi, Ghana and Nigeria, repatriating thousands of their citizens following violent protests and attacks targeting migrants. Mozambique claims that five of its nationals were killed in, quote, xenophobic attacks in the southern coastal town of Mossel Bay over the weekend. The local police have confirmed two deaths. Tensions have been growing in recent months, with South Africans accusing migrants of straining social services, bringing crime and taking their jobs. And a homegrown citizens group called March and March created panic after posting notices online which appeared to mimic official government papers calling for undocumented foreigners to leave the country by June the 30th or face arrest, detention and deportation. There are also reports of vigilante groups going door to door demanding to see people's documents, of families being dragged from their homes and houses being torched with people inside. South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, has called for calm while also announcing a crackdown on illegal immigration. William Gumede is the founder and chair of the Democracy Works Foundation, and he joined me from Johannesburg. William, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Hello, thank you for having me.
William, this started as an isolated protest in some of the small towns, but it appears to have morphed into a broader protest movement, and now we've got foreign governments evacuating their citizens. What is this about? Is it driven by xenophobia?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, this is an unprecedented crisis in the country. We've seen in the past waves of xenophobia, but this seems to be much more serious. One reason why it is so serious is South Africa is currently facing an economic crisis, certainly, possibly, the worst crisis in our modern history, the worst economic crisis, with high unemployment, particularly youth unemployment. And it now drives, it appears to be, this level of xenophobia. And it started in the small towns, and it now seems to be to have spread to some of the bigger towns also.
Okay, well, let's drill down a bit into that because, as you say, unemployment is high, around 32%, but for younger people, as I understand it, it's more than 60%, which is a genuine cause for distress and grievance. But you're saying it's not necessarily migration. Do you think it's migration, legal or illegal, to blame here or contributing here?
No. You know, migration is not a real issue. We're having a really important local government election. And normally in the past, these sort of anti-migrant sentiments, it always seems to happen just ahead of elections. So that's the first thing. So for the first time, we also now have politicians that are whipping up the migrant issue as a political issue. Now, this has never happened in South Africa. You know, we had isolated sort of attacks and criticism of African migrants, but this time it is a political issue. You also, the context is also is that the ANC, the African National Congress, that has dominated South Africa's politics for the last 30 years, is now in almost terminal decline. And the ANC in the past, when it was very dominant, pushed back against this sort of anti-migration sentiment. Mm. Now the party doesn't have the power and the authority and the credibility. And we've seen the last couple of months in the vacuum that has opened up in the ANC's decline, a number of individuals and groups that have used the space to mobilize to get into politics.
Uh-huh. And let's talk about the ANC position, because the government spokesperson said this week that the ANC government remains committed to the rule of law and the protection of foreign nationals. It's important to understand the character of migration to South Africa, going on to explain that when the ANC was first elected, the new policy allowed social integration rather than strict migrant containment. Now, that's a very generous sentiment, but how did the reality occur? Did ANC governments resource and support social integration?
No, and perhaps that's the problem. So the policy, the ANC had a very, very liberal policy in 1994 when it came to power. And there was a context to that liberal policy. During the anti-apartheid struggle, many, many South Africans who fought the apartheid government went into exile. And so many returned back. Hundreds of thousands, if not close to a million people, returned back. And the ANC had a very, very generous policy at the time, because many, many South Africans who fought the apartheid government were based in other countries, neighboring countries, or in Eastern Europe, or in Europe. So that was, it was a really open door policy. Now, unfortunately, that open door policy has crashed now. It is crashed because, we did not, as a country, we did not get the economic growth the last decade. So the economy hasn't been growing. And at the same time, also, we've had state failure in many departments, and particularly rural towns. So the rural towns have struggled economically. So now we've been sitting with people who've come from other African countries and from the rest of the world, Asia, in particular Pakistan, and so on, while the economy hasn't been growing and the state hasn't been able to deliver for more people that are now in South Africa.
Okay, you're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is William Gumede. He's the founder and chair of the South African-based Democracy Works Foundation. He's been a long-time advisor to the government in the past. So you talked about their failure of the rule of law. You've talked about high unemployment, lack of economic growth, the government losing control of the border. These fit neatly into the grievances of those who are protesting on the streets and violently protesting and threatening immigrants, both documented and undocumented. Does all of that create legitimate concern amongst South Africans who can't get a job, who can't get access to social services because the government's bungled the economy and they're not provided for, who doesn't feel safe in the streets because the police are, what did you say, corrupt or incompetent?
It's legitimate grievances, but unfortunately, it is directed in the wrong way. By directing it at foreigners, that really is misspending energy. The focus will have to be on the government and the elected officials. People are elected to do a job, and they need to be held accountable. Mm. For example, if we kick out every migrant in South Africa, South Africa will still face with the same issues. We will still face with low economic growth. We will still be faced with a public service that's in a total paralysis, and reforms are too slow. And we will still be faced with our police service that's generally lacks the confidence also. That's the other part. I did say incompetence, but it also appears that the police lacks the confidence because they don't know what policy to apply. I mean, I must say just, you know, overall, South Africa right now is in a sort of upside down moment where we have ANC in decline, but still dominant, although not, you know, doesn't have an overall majority. And our president, Cyril Ramaphosa, you know, he's also facing an inquiry. He's facing an impeachment. So, and so we are really in a power vacuum in the country, and there's a local government elections coming. And I think there are many elements of the sort of populist politicians and parties that are now using this migrant issue and raising it and blaming it for all of South Africa's problems. And then also there's online, there is, you know, lots of misinformation about migrants.
I was going to ask you about that, what the numbers tell us. Has there been an upsurge in migration, particularly in illegal migration, which is one of the claims by the groups who are taking to the streets?
Yes, there has been an upsurge, but not in the sort of the millions that, you know, there's sort of people are claiming online that, you know, that we're having, you know, upwards to 10 million migrants from the rest of Africa and from Asia. You know, that's simply not true. I mean, it's, you know, it's, there's no factual basis and so on. But sadly, many of the general public do believe that. That is the case. And also in the context of that, the South Africans, let's call it the indigenous population, haven't been growing the last decades. So, I mean, our population has actually been growing through migration and not growing through locals. So it's been and so on. So that's also is the context of people being smaller families or no children and so on, and then the rise of migration. But I must also tell you that you know, the rest of Africa is sitting currently in a big economic crisis. Many African countries are in economic crisis. You know, it started off with the Trump administration's tough policies, cutting off development aid, raising tariffs, and now the war in the Middle East, because, you know, most of the African countries are in these choke points.
Yeah.
I mean, it. So the migration then moves to South Africa, because it's very tough these days to move from a poor African country to Europe or to the US. So South Africa is the other option then.
And is there a legacy issue there too? Because I've seen commentary suggesting that, you know, the ANC governments of the past have actually supported governments that turned out to be dictatorships, sometimes cruel dictatorships, and that kind of authoritarian rule is also making people move, leave the country for safety, and they're heading to South Africa.
Absolutely, it's a legacy issue. So in a way, the ANC is, you know, also to blame for this. Just look at, you know, the ANC has been supporting or beefing up, for example, in Zimbabwe, ZANU-PF and the late Robert Mugabe, instead of supporting the opposition. And that country is a failed state, so people flee to South Africa. The same was in Mozambique. Last year, Mozambique had a failed election where the opposition parties said that the election was stolen. And then again, President Ramaphosa went there to supposedly mediate, but he actually supported the governing party that was autocratic. And, you know, a lot of Mozambicans came to South Africa. The same is in Angola. And if you remember a couple of years ago when President Jacob Zuma was the president, I mean, he supported al-Bashir in Sudan. And the courts in South Africa had to hold him to account. And then now Sudan has broken up. And where else can people come than to South Africa? I mean, the same we can talk about in Somalia and those sort of places, and we can go further north. You know, it's the same situation.
You're listening to Radio National Hour. My guest is William Gamede. William's a democracy and governance expert in South Africa, and we're talking about, well, the rise of xenophobia and violent xenophobia in his homeland there, being played out against other African migrants. You talked there, it's very reminiscent of a lot that's going on in the world, when you talked about a power vacuum, elements of populist parties, you know, agitating here, online misinformation, disinformation. We're seeing similar elements and similar anti-migration sentiment take hold in other parts of the world, aren't we? I mean, notably the United States with its ICE operations across major cities, but big protests and riots again now in the UK. Do you see this as having any influence on attitudes in South Africa, on what's happening in South Africa, the timing or the sentiment behind these protests?
You know, it's also been reinforced by what's happening around the world, that people are seeing, South Africans are seeing that other countries are clamping down on migrants, and they want the same from their government. So, yes, you asked earlier just about the numbers. South Africa is a smaller economy. If you compare it to other countries, to other, you know, migrants, the sort of the numbers, yes, there is a case to be made that we have proportionally compared around the world, most probably more than most countries, a higher number of migrants coming to South Africa compared to other countries. I mean, in Africa, we have the highest numbers. But the issue is, you know, it had its origin that when the ANC became the power in 1994, it had a very, very liberal and generous policies to bring to allow people to come to South Africa.
William, thank you very much for joining me here on the Radio National Hour.
No, thank you for having me.
That's William Gumede. He's the founder and chair of the Democracy Works Foundation and associate professor at the School of Governance at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. You're listening to the Radio National Hour.
Coming up on Big Ideas with Natasha Mitchell.
The housing crisis has sparked furious debates about tax, about policy, about equity. Two champions of Australian architecture and design, Anthony Burke and Tim Ross, get together to ask, can we design our way out of this mess? Don't miss them.
Big Ideas. Catch big thinkers at the best live events. Tonight from 8 on ABC Radio National.
The Radio National Hour. With Fran Kelly.
As Australia grapples with a housing system built around private ownership and investor-driven rentals, one model has almost slipped out of view in recent years: cooperative housing, where residents don't just rent, but they actually help run and manage their housing and offers affordability and stability without the burden of a mortgage. As we touched on in earlier interviews in this housing series we're doing, this approach, just like community land trusts, which we spoke about on Monday, targets the missing middle, people who aren't in need of social housing but might not earn enough to compete in the private housing market, particularly in some of our capital cities. At one point, housing co-ops were actively supported by government in Australia. That was back in the 80s. Today, co-ops represent less than 1% of the community housing market. Overseas, it's a very different story. In countries like Denmark, Austria, and Norway, cooperative housing operates at scale, providing up to 40% of housing stock in some cases, while keeping housing affordable and providing lifelong security. Advocates say with the right funding arrangements, policies, and a shift in mindset, we could replicate the model successfully here. And two women working hard to make this a reality are Sidsel Grimstad, a Norwegian-born researcher who's spent decades studying cooperative housing, a couple of decades here in Australia and internationally. Sidsel is an adjunct senior lecturer at Griffith University in Queensland, although she's currently living in a co-op herself in Oslo in Norway. And Melina Morrison is the CEO of the Business Council of Cooperatives and Mutuals. Sidsel, Melina, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Good afternoon.
Thank you so much, Fran.
Melina, for listeners who've never come across this model before, what is a housing co-op and what makes it different from an ordinary rental or a property someone might own on the private market?
Well, you do still have ownership rights, and really the real difference is that you're buying into a share in a property that's owned in common by other people that want to live in affordable housing as well. So you're building a community and you're able to access all of the rights of permanent tenure of private ownership that we've learnt to take for granted with home ownership, which is that it is permanent tenure. You can live in it as long as you want to. In Europe, and we'll talk more about that with Sidsel, you buy in and you sell out of cooperative housing, so you have complete flexibility, but you get to stay where you want to live and you build a community around that housing, which is the other part of home ownership that we quite often don't talk about, the social cohesion and the ability to live close to where you want to work and be educated.
So in a way, it's just a different model of affordable housing.
Absolutely. And what we're really seeing the opportunity in Australia is to think about this as a pathway to private home ownership, if that's the pathway you want to take. Many people need to be in permanent tenure, close to where they're being educated or work, in order to save more quickly for a home loan to get into the housing market.
So how much opportunity is there for people at the moment, for perhaps the essential workers? We always talk about the nurses or the teachers or the police or the fireys. Australia has around 8,000 cooperative properties, I understand. Where are they and what do they look like? Are we driving past them every day without realising?
Absolutely. A lot of them, the biggest sector, part of those 8,000 are the 2,000 properties across Victoria, but a lot of those are in metropolitan Melbourne. So these are housing developments that are built in the same shape as that we know our other housing, you know, townhouses, some blocks of apartments, but also individual residences, depending on where they are. It's a very flexible housing form.
Let's talk about your experience, Sidsel, because as Melina said, you're living in a co-op right now in Oslo, in Norway. How different does it look or feel to living in the sort of private homes we have in Australia?
Well, we have a housing co-op flat in Oslo, and I'm on the board of that housing co-op, and it's a co-op of 34 units, and it's inner city. And what happens is that because we have an elected board of the residents in the co-op, the board is then responsible for good financial management and maintenance.
So like a body corporate? And
yeah, it is actually quite similar to a strata title. But the difference is that we, as residents, are actively involved in making decisions, and we have a lot of agency in that sense. We are heavily supported by the Federation, the Housing Cooperative Federation in Oslo, OBOS. It's a huge federation. It has around a million members.
So a million members.
The scale of this is quite enormous. And there's in Oslo, around 38 to 40% of the housing stock are now these housing, are comprises housing co-ops.
Right.
In a housing complex, the cooperative owns the building, and then you buy a membership and the right to live there as it is your home for as long as you want. However, now we see a tendency, and it's becoming more and more popular, that we see limited equity solutions here because it.
What does that mean? Limited.
It means, yeah, and because we have a large co-op sector here, the Federation or the UBUS, the co-op, for first home buyers, you can go in and your upfront capital investment or equity investment is a part of the market rate. And then the co-op takes on the other part.
So
and
can
that
I just ask
very
you,
popular.
On an equity-based co-op, you said you buy in at market price. So why would anyone do that? If it's not cheaper, if it's not more affordable than the general housing market, why would you do that? Yeah.
It's slightly more affordable, I would say, because if you buy a private property, you can rent it out as Airbnb. And one of the benefits of housing co-ops is that there's very strong restrictions on Airbnb using it for short-term rentals. You can't really. And so you can imagine if you have a city where you have around 40% housing co-ops and Airbnb is not allowed in 40% of the housing stock, that keeps kind of a lid on what we see in other big cities like Barcelona and where Airbnb is taking over from short-term rentals.
I see. Melina, yeah. That is not how they work here, as I understand it. It's mostly rental, is that right? How does it work here?
Yes, so in Australia, if you qualify to get into community housing and you're fortunate enough to be on the list to get into a cooperative housing, but you pay 25% of household income capped at the market rent, and then that market rent cross-subsidises other people in the housing cooperative that are on lower incomes.
Okay, so the value of it is that as a renter, you have housing security and stability, which you don't mostly have in the private rental market.
Yes, and you have housing like you own it. The things that we take for granted as homeowners, the right to be able to make choices around how your housing is managed, and you know the things that you'd like to develop as a community, as well as the permanency of tenure. Housing cooperatives are a way of bringing in the equity of the residents as they come in, but it doesn't have to be at the full market rate. And that's where the affordability is.
You're listening to Radio National Hour. My guests are Sitzel Grimstar. Sitzel is a researcher with Griffith University, a specialist researcher in co-op housing here in Australia for decades. And Melina Morrison is the CEO of the Peak Body for Cooperatives in Australia. Melina, for a long time, Victoria was the state that was most amenable to co-ops. It has stronger institutional support behind it, I think. So what sort of supports are we talking about, and how is it, how different is Victoria and the setup for co-ops and the support for co-ops than other states?
Yes, so Victoria spearheaded what is known as the common equity housing cooperatives, which are really the development and management side of these individual housing cooperatives. So the best way to think of a cooperative, it is a type of business. It's an enterprise which secures the home as a total, you know, could be a group of flats, but allows the tenants to be the managers of that property. And then common equity are the umbrella bodies that sit over these housing cooperatives and help them with all of the shared services needs. And what the Victorian government did four decades ago is that they allowed the head leases to go to this community housing development sector. And they've been able to use their own balance sheet as leverage to build more housing in this model. So that is why, of all of the states in Australia, Victoria has the most number of rental housing cooperatives.
And how do they kick off? Like, who gives them the funding? Is it government funded initially to buy the package of, you know, co-op housing, or is it philanthropic, or is it investor based? How does it work?
Well, the housing developers, as they are in Europe as well, are what you would call non-profit housing developers. So they build off their own balance sheets, so their own reserves or capital, as well as lending from banks and other forms of finance. And so in many ways they look like an ordinary housing developer, but they have the non-profit ethos and driver, so they're able to develop the highest quality housing at the lowest possible profit margin.
Sitzel, how many non-profit housing developers are there? It almost seems like a contradiction in terms. How does it work in Europe?
For instance, in Denmark, which has a very large rental housing cooperative sector, actually every five Danes lives in one of those. They have developed a very interesting funding model where you can have commercial developers, but the funding model keeps the housing cost down because they have developed a national housing development fund, which is now so big that it is secures funding in perpetuity of affordable housing co-ops. But the important thing that I think Melina mentioned is that we see that having members put in some equity in the housing, and it can, in Denmark it's as low as 2%, so it's very small, but you can have, you know, there's a wide variety of how much equity members can put in. That is quite important because then it becomes even more your own, so to speak.
Yes.
You know, like it's,
and
have skin
and more
in the game and so on.
You have skin in the game, but it's also a democratic model, isn't it, that if you don't have much, you can
Absolutely.
Still be a part of it. Sitzel,
yes.
Australia did support housing co-ops more actively in the 1980s. I remember a lot of them starting up at that time, and some of them are still around. Maybe a lot of them are still around. Why did
a
the
lot
model
of them are still around.
why did yes. the model fall out of the mainstream here?
I think for a short period under the Hawke government, they decided to put a line of credit targeted to local government and community housing development. And I think they were quite inspired by Europe's housing cooperative sectors. And it was quite interesting because it was quite self-organized, and that's why they are still, most of them are still active and thriving. But then this arrangement disappeared with a change of government, who didn't see this as a suitable model. There was more focus on ownership, basically.
And Melina, you mentioned that there's a long waiting list for cooperative housing in this country. I think you said it's about 10,000 people. Does that suggest that if we had a government of the mindset that the Hawke government was, for instance, there would be a demand for this kind of housing? What would need to shift, or what would need to occur to have that sort of spurt of growth in co-ops?
Well, we have some positive news, because the government is recognising this housing tenure. So some of that history that Sitzel just shared is changing. For a while, we really haven't had the driver to look at alternative housing models. And, you know, a lot of things are driven by crisis. The very mature sector you see across Europe now, where cooperative housing is another form of housing asset, very reliable, that institutional capital wants to fund, we need to get there. So what is very encouraging is that the National Housing Supply and Affordability Council, that sits under the Federal Housing Minister, recognises cooperative housing as being one of the forms of tenure in housing that's part of the continuum that we need to encourage. There's nothing really stopping this but for a lack of awareness.
I understand that you took the Housing Minister, Claire O'Neill, Federal Housing Minister, and the Federal Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, on a tour of a co-op earlier this year. What was their response? Did you feel like they were interested, significantly interested?
Yes, well, absolutely. We were delighted to have the Housing Minister and the Federal Treasurer. And, you know, they're quite joyous at tours and opportunities to engage with people who say, this housing has changed my life. And the thing that changes people's life is the ability to stop worrying about housing, to know that not only is it secure and permanent for as long as they need to live there and their children need to live there, but that it also is building a community that is stable. You know, building social connections is part of what is really so beneficial about housing cooperatives.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guests here, we're talking about cooperative housing. Another part, the final part in our series this week of alternative housing models, as we try and look at how to jumpstart and get innovative about housing solutions in Australia at the moment as we struggle through this housing crisis. My guests are Sidsel Grimstar from Griffith University, who's joining us from Oslo, where she's currently living in a housing cooperative, and Melina Morrison from the cooperative Peak Body here in Australia. Just to finish off, Melina, you talked about nothing stopping this but a lack of awareness, and you say people are open to it. But I do wonder whether mindset is an issue. I mean, in this country, home ownership is very much embedded in our national psyche as a wealth creation tool. Yes, it's a home, but it's also an asset. Would that mindset need to change if Australians are to embrace co-ops in meaningful numbers? And how do you do that?
Look, I think the circumstances that people find their lives are encouraging them to look at different ways of living. When we think of home ownership, what we're really thinking about is, where do I live? What is my home going to look like? What is my future going to look like? And this is not an either or. There's no forcing of one model against another. We have had for many generations, because it has built such intergenerational wealth, a pathway into home ownership. Now those pathways are closing, and we need to open up other doorways, pardon the pun. And so we need to be more imaginative and think more laterally. And we find when you survey people in the community around this, in fact, this housing study has been done with people who are aging, that if there are alternative models, the model that they would most choose is a housing cooperative, because they see the sense that they can shift their retirement living circumstances to a community but still have autonomy over their housing. We have, for example, in Sydney, a very long-standing, very successful student governed and managed housing cooperative, which has been providing secure rent for people while they've been undertaking their education at the University of Sydney for many decades.
Yeah. Just finally to you, Sidsel, from your own experience, both living in a co-op but also researching co-ops, particularly here in Australia, What do you think people who've only ever known private renting or mortgage stress most misunderstand about this way of housing people? And, you know, do they think it's just for hippies, or it's not for them because it's not really home ownership? What's your pitch for co-op living?
Well, that's it is often misconstrued that it is like hippie communes, but when you have 40% of the housing stock being just normal flats, so to speak, the big advantage is that you have agency over your living area. You know, we do take part in making decisions that affect all the residents in the co-op. We are very concerned about any rises in rent, because we know in our co-op particularly, there's a lot of young people who really have a very tight budget. You know, the board are residents, and we know where the shoe is hurting. But there are the co-op model. And creates a social capital in the cities that are very helpful when we want to have a say in the planning in the city. We want to have better spaces for children. And the big federation, have developed an app which is called Neighbor Help. And within your co-op, you can say, oh, I need somebody to water my plants during holiday. Can anybody help me? Or so there are the co-op structure, which is both a financial model and the governance model. It also creates social capital where people know each other, get to know each other better.
Sounds fabulous to me. Secure, stable, affordable housing with social contact within it. Sounds like a model for now, if you ask me. Melina and Sitzel, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's Sitzel Grimstar. She's an adjunct senior lecturer at Griffith University in Queensland, currently living in a housing co-op in Oslo. And Melina Morrison is the CEO of the Business Council of Cooperatives and Mutual. And this was the fourth and final episode in a series this week we've been running, focusing on more creative solutions to Australia's housing crisis. If you missed any of our others, if you want to listen back to our previous stories on community land trusts, on prefabricated housing, and on social and affordable housing, they're available, as always, on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. As Gaza's fragile ceasefire continues to be tested by airstrikes and violations on both sides, civilians are still crammed in so-called safe zones, living in tents amongst the rubble of bombed towns, services, schools, even hospitals razed to the ground. A loss of life, but also a loss of place, the cost of this war. At the same time, there's an increasingly urgent question about how to make sense of what's unfolding. Not just the scale of destruction, but whether there are patterns behind it and what those patterns might reveal about the intention of the war. Professor Eyal Weissman has spent years trying to answer exactly that question. As the founder of Forensic Architecture, a research agency based at Goldsmiths, University of London, his work pieces together satellite imagery, eyewitness footage, mapping and open source data to investigate incidents of violence. And he's applied that model to the conflict in Gaza. His work now being used in international legal proceedings, including submissions to the International Court of Justice examining allegations of genocide in Gaza. His new book is called Ungrounding, The Architecture of Genocide, and it brings those investigations together, arguing that when you map thousands of individual incidents over time, they form a coherent and intentional pattern of destruction, displacement, and control. Eyal Weissman, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Happy to be here.
Eyal, can I start with the basic question, which is, what is forensic architecture? I've not come across this before.
Yeah, forensic architecture is a research agency providing architectural evidence to international legal bodies. Now, you'd ask, what is architectural evidence? Now, most conflict these days take place in cities. And that means that buildings and neighborhoods bear the brunt of state violence. And just like the human body is the subject of forensic pathology, the building and the built environment is the subject of forensic architecture. That is to say, we look at the wounds that are inflicted on architectural environment. And we read sometimes in the shape of the rubble left behind, we figure out what has happened. Almost, if you like, you can think of it as archaeology of the present. You look at the particular archaeologists, look at ruins maybe decades ago or centuries ago, and figure out what has taken place. And we look at things as they unfold, as destruction, as it unfolds. And this is what makes it also a very extremely difficult practice to undertake.
And is this what, in the book, you talk about a kind of deep cartography of Gaza? Is this what you mean when you say that?
The book is dealing very much with the geology of Gaza. When we think about an area such as the Gaza Strip, we can hardly imagine it being a natural environment. But Gaza, it has a very particular ecology. It is existing at the threshold of the desert. It has two very distinct types of soil. There is sand, barren sand dunes right along the coastline, and there is fertile alluvial soil in its eastern part. Mm-hmm. And what you've seen is that those natural conditions have actually guided the logic of the genocide. Palestinians were pushed from the north of Gaza, which is much more rain-rich, into the southern part, and they were also pushed from the fertile land in the east part of the Gaza Strip toward the coastal dunes where no conditions of life exist. Now, what the book tried to claim is that these are patterns that are explicit in the history of settler colonialism. Think about the history also of Australian settler colonialism and the way in which Indigenous people were pushed gradually from the fertile lands into the desert part of the country.
So this, to be clear, this is not an analysis that only applies to Gaza, that you've only applied to Gaza.
Forensic architecture worked on several genocide cases. We've worked on the German imperial genocide. We were working on a genocide in Guatemala, in which the Guatemalan military in 1982 destroyed the forest area of the Ishil Maya people. In all those cases, what we see is that settler colonial genocide actually targets the environment. The environment as the conditions of life of those people. And we, unfortunately, we're seeing those at play in Gaza by the Israeli occupation forces.
Well, before we go any further, I think it is important to say that Israel completely rejects that characterization of this conflict entirely. It says it's acting in self-defense against Hamas and it's taking steps to protect civilians. And it also, of course, has rejected the claims that it's committing genocide. And while the ICJ did find the claims of genocide in Gaza were plausible and ordered Israel to take steps to prevent that, we're still waiting for a determination by the court, but Israel rejects it completely. Now, how do you respond to Israel's stance that it's acting in self-defense against Hamas and it's actually trying to protect civilians?
So when you look at an actual conflict, you would expect to see patterns of attack that are sporadic, that are happening where skirmishes or encounters between military forces are. But what you see in Gaza is a complete carpet of destruction. In the area that now Israel controls in Gaza, this 60% that is behind the so-called yellow line, everything has been uprooted. And when I say everything, I mean every piece of infrastructure that runs under the subsoil, water, electricity, sewage, every field, every forest, every building, every school, every hospital, every mosque, every public facility. That does not actually represent a pattern of encounter between a guerrilla force and a military formation. The patterns simply do not match. In all conflicts, there is a term that really helps us to understand it. In Guatemala, when I was giving expert opinion in a genocide case, the Guatemalan military said, "We are draining the river to kill the fish." draining the river to kill the fish is destroying everything. The river is the environment. The river is a society. The river is the lived environment of a certain society. When your destruction is so complete, when you expel the entirety of the population, there is no place to speak about military necessity. Military necessity is a very special type, and the rules about it are very, very specific. Military are allowed to target, armed forces. They need to act with proportionality, and nothing of that is what we've seen. In fact, my team has probably looked at more videos coming from Gaza than any organization. We are talking about tens and tens of thousands of videos, each one verified, each one located, each one showing a different type of atrocity committed. And we're seeing the relation between those multiple types of destruction and atrocities committed, adding up to a picture in which Israel tries to displace Palestinians from the Strip, or at least, if they cannot really get them out of the border, out of the best part of the Gaza Strip.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is forensic architecture founder and author Eyal Weitzman, and we're talking about his analysis of the violence in Gaza, which he's documented in his new book, Ungrounding. I mean, again, I say that Israel completely rejects your characterization, and there's probably a lot of people listening who say, well, everything you described is just the tragic reality of urban warfare, especially against an adversary embedded among civilians. How do you respond to that?
Well, this is not urban warfare, because urban warfare is a war, the type of war that happens in urban environment. This type of war has completely de-urbanized the environment. There was a refugee camp called Jabalia. There was a city called Rafah. There was a city called Sajaiya. There was a city called Beit Hanun. They do not exist. They are simply piles of ruin, a desert that has been created. Everything in them has been destroyed. I don't think the characterization of urban warfare is capturing anything of the logic of this war.
In the book, you mentioned the Palestinian poet Omar Musa, and he's quoting a friend saying, if we survive this war, what would be our meeting point? I thought that was a very powerful question. And is that what you're concluding here, that erasing an urban landscape so totally to produce a blank landscape effectively also erases any opportunity for society, for social contact, for rebuilding?
Yeah, absolutely. The Genocide Convention prohibits the destruction of conditions of life. That is not only about killing individuals or killing civilians in large numbers. It is about killing the possibility of life to happen in a particular place. What is the conditions of life of a society? These are the infrastructure, the institutions of health, say, for example, conditions of cultural life, so schools and mosques. Conditions of life are obviously the homes. Conditions of life depend on agriculture, on forest, on open green area. All those things have been systematically, not sporadically, systematically destroyed. Not only were they destroyed, they've been reshaped. If you would go back and I've heard testimonies both by Palestinians and by Israeli soldiers who describe a new type of torture. A Palestinian who was, say, from Jabalia or from another city that was destroyed, is taken back and put back at the place where they lived before. At that moment, their blindfold is being removed, and the panic that ensued by the complete dissonance of not being able to recognize anything that is familiar to you is what creates that form of alienation. Now, in the history of Palestine, this is not the first time that we have seen that kind of destruction. During and after the Nakba of 1947 to 48, a time that Israel called the War of Independence, Entire Palestinian towns and villages were destroyed. Not only destroyed, they were plowed over. The reason was so that Palestinian refugees would not return, would give up their right of return and would not return to the places from which they were displaced. And I think this is what we're seeing now. And Israeli politicians are talking very clearly about the fact that they do not want to withdraw from that 60%. Now Netanyahu says he wants to expand it to 70% of Gaza territory from which Palestinians have been displaced. They will never come back there. And because they have nothing to come back there. All they will find is sand. And I think this is the tragic continuity of Palestinian history, of uprooting and ungrounding, and the denial of the possibility of return.
Professor Eyal Weissman is my guest. He's the founder of the research agency Forensic Architecture at Goldsmiths University. Just finally, your work, this work, and you are the founder of this kind of forensic architecture project, is being used in international legal settings, including submissions to the International Court of Justice. What role do you think this kind of evidence will and can realistically play in holding states to account?
It is a revolution in evidentiary affair, if you like. In the past, experts had to travel to the ground. Photojournalists were sent to take photos. Today, the most important bits of evidence come from the people themselves, recorded on their phones, written on blogs, and posted online. This, however, requires a very, very serious process of verification and geolocation. We go through this process so that every video that we receive, we investigate. Is it fake or is it not? Where was it taken? How does it link to other videos? Today, the best way to identify a video that was manipulated is when it doesn't link to others. Around each incident, you have today dozens, if not hundreds, of independent, separate videos, and they all need to capture more or less the same thing. During the Gaza genocide, the majority of the evidence produced is produced on the ground. Indeed, also by Israeli soldiers, sometimes with, sometimes without military understanding and consent. They take their phones in. Very often, they record their own atrocities. And of course, perpetrator videos are, almost like an admission of guilt. And what one has to do from our perspective is to show that the behavior of Israeli soldiers on the ground is not an aberration, but a certain normative behavior that responds to the atmosphere, the social atmosphere, to political speech, to speech within the media, etc., to incitement on all those levels. And this is how you build a case for a systematic nature of a genocide rather than individual aberration by soldiers. For example, the Israeli prime minister allude to the biblical story of the Amalekites. Amalekites are a biblical people that the Israelites were asked by God to destroy down to the last child and down to the last livestock. When Israeli soldiers hear from the prime minister that the Gazans are Amalekites, and when they go on the ground repeating that term, graffitiing the term Amalek on destroyed Palestinian homes, you understand that these are not acts of aberration, but part of a systemic, normative, cultural norm that the Israeli army is actually following.
Eyal Weissman, thank you very much for joining me.
It was a pleasure.
That's Professor Eyal Weissman. He's the founder of the research agency Forensic Architecture at Goldsmiths University of London and the author of this new book called Ungrounding, The Architecture of Genocide. And that's it from me for today. Thanks for your company, as always. This is me done for the week, so thanks too to the hardworking team behind the scenes here on the Radio National Hour. And Barb will be with you tomorrow with some gorgeous music from Nigerian musician Shian Kuti. He's the youngest son of Afrobeat pioneer Fela Kuti, who's keeping the dream alive, touring with his father's band Egypt 80. You won't want to miss that, I promise you. I'll see you next week. Good night.